Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Will Falk. He's a biophilic writer and lawyer. The natural world speaks, and Will's work is how he listens. He believes the intensifying destruction of the natural world is the most pressing issue confronting us today. His first book, How Dams Fail, Stories the Colorado River Told Me, will be released by Homebound Publications in October 2019. You can follow Will's work at willfalk.org. That's willfalk.org. So first, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
So first, what you say you're a biophilic writer and lawyer. What does that mean?
Well, the basic definition of biophilic is lover of life. And I use that term very intentionally, and I use it to differentiate myself from and to prioritize life over merely human concerns. So I think a good antonym for biophilic would be perhaps anthropocentric. Everything has to do with humans, and everything is based on human needs. So I think that one of the problems, and we'll talk about this more, but one of the problems with the environmental movement is it is only concerned with human problems. And because it's only concerned with human problems, it's been largely ineffective. So I use the term biophilic to try and differentiate myself from that viewpoint, and to try and challenge the anthropocentric view of the world, try to challenge things like human supremacism in my work. I think that that's really important, because I think that for the most part, people don't even understand that we live in a human supremacist society, a human supremacist culture. And human supremacism is much like white supremacism. Human supremacism is the notion that humans are superior to every other form of life on the planet. And because humans are superior, the rest of the planet exists to benefit humans. And under human supremacy, humans can justify all sorts of atrocities, can justify the ecocide that has been going on since the dawn of civilization. So I use the term biophilic to counter anthropocentrism and human supremacism, and just to remind people and myself that the point of all our work is life in general, and not just human desires and human fantasies.
So my next question could fill probably 12 volumes in the answer, 12 volumes in a book. So this next question could lead to you talking for, I don't know, we could do a filibuster with you talking for the next 35 hours, but can you tell us, give us a quick primer on how the law currently is not biophilic and human supremacist, and it is human supremacist.
Yeah, so you're right. That could be a filibuster. I think I'll start with law. The American system of law is inherited from the old English system of law. The United States being originally colonies of Great Britain. And the United States especially was formed right in the foundational era of liberal economics, of liberal, the classic liberal politics. You know, Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations was writing. I think he published that book in 1776. That's the foundational text of capitalism. So the people who wrote the Constitution, the white men that founded this country, were thorough believers in the notion that capitalism is the right economic system, that human progress is the most important thing, that the development of natural resources, the exploitation of so-called natural resources, was the way to prosperity for, well, themselves, first of all, as slave-owning white men. But what's really important is that they wrote the Constitution at this time. And the Constitution is, I've heard it compared to the source code, to use a computer programming metaphor. The Constitution is the very basis of law in the United States. And part of the Constitution, there's the Commerce Clause, but even more importantly, I guess, or I should say first, is the notion that, every human has the right to, life, liberty, and property. That's part of the preamble to the Constitution. And property is classically defined as objects, and the natural world, it fits into this. The natural world under a liberal economic system is nothing but property to be used and consumed by humans. And the fact that this is written right into the Constitution makes it a very powerful idea that has governed American law for the last close to 300 years. Law at its very beginning is anthropocentric. Human beings' right to use property that they have acquired. Originally, this was mainly land. The ability to use land in a way that benefited the property owner is fundamental to everything that has followed in American law. An even deeper problem with this isn't just the way that it protects humans to do this. Law is also a force of social morality. It shapes the way that people think what is right and what is wrong. A lot of times, I think even in our own thinking, we sometimes think we confuse legality with the right thing to do and illegality with the wrong thing to do. So what, the foundational document, the Constitution, has done to generations of at least Americans, and you could also argue the dozens and dozens of countries that have written constitutions since the American Constitution, around the world, what this has done is it has taught generations of humans that nature is nothing more than property, and has taught humans so thoroughly that thinking of nature as anything but property is completely unheard of. It's the idea that nature is property has become invisible in to most Americans and to most humans around the world. And I think that this idea, there might not be a more destructive idea than this one, at least in the law. So that's how it started. That's how the American legal system started as human supremacist. But then as the Industrial Revolution happened, kind of getting its beginnings in the 1770s, 1780s, when the American government was first founded, there's been all kinds of things that have re-entrenched that idea. I think one of the big ideas has been a series of Supreme Court decisions since the 1800s that grant corporations greater rights than most communities have in the United States, and it gives corporations access to the power that government represents. Because corporations are bestowed with certain property rights under American law, when those rights are interfered with, they can call on the American system of government for the physical force they need to ensure that whatever they want to do gets done. So the easiest example of this is a pipeline. Once a corporation acquires property rights or access to land to build a pipeline, If someone tries to stop them building that pipeline, they can bring a lawsuit in court and ask a judge to order the police or the National Guard to enforce their right to build that pipeline. So the nation that, or the notion
and even,
that.
And even when they don't acquire the property rights, they can still be taken.
Yeah. They can petition, and corporations have gotten so powerful. They've been so powerful for a long time, but they've gotten so powerful that they can even access the legislative process to, they can go into Congress and say, hey, we want to build this big pipeline. It's going to it's going to be good for the country. It's going to create a lot of jobs. It's going to, you do all the things, you know, it's going to give us the energy that we need to live the way we do. And Congress can appropriate that land from landowners and, again, use the full power of the government, the full physical force of the government to make sure that the pipeline is built. So I think those two ideas that nature is nothing more than property has no access to the court system to enforce a right to exist, to naturally evolve, to thrive. That's the first big problem with American law that has haunted the English system of law from the beginning. And the second big idea is that corporations have oftentimes been bestowed with as many rights as human beings, and definitely as many rights as communities who would oppose destructive projects. Another big problem with American law that has grown in the last 50 or 60 years is this whole regulatory framework of laws that, like the Endangered Species Act or the National Environmental Policy Act, laws that are the rhetoric with which they were passed was that they are to regulate the industries that are destroying the planet. And what has actually happened in the last 60 years is environmentalists have spent way too much energy trying to use these laws to stop the destruction, but government agencies don't apply the laws the way that environmentalists understand them to be written, and corporations, again, have enough power to influence the legislature to write in loopholes to these laws, and the destruction just continues. I think the Endangered Species Act, I always think of as a really good example. It was passed in 1973, and it has all this rhetoric about how the American government wants to stop the extinction of species. It wants to do everything it can to stop these to stop species from going extinct. I think it passed in the Senate, at least. I think there wasn't any votes against it when it actually passed in 1973. Unfortunately, since around 1970, scientists say that there's been 50% decline in wildlife population since 1970. So in other words, if you took every...
I want to just point out that that's after a huge decline from 1930, which is after a huge decline from 1890, which is after a huge decline from 1830, which is after a huge decline from 1790, and so on.
Absolutely.
Anyway, Sean, go ahead.
Yeah, and that's a really important point, because part of what the Endangered Species Act does is it provides for a definition of what an endangered species is. So there are, for instance, I think they delisted the polar bears a few years ago. So in order for a species to get on the endangered species list, it has to have had endured centuries of slaughter, of domination. So, you know, even by definition, the definitions of endangered species require that species to have experienced a tremendous amount of destruction before it's even put on the list. But to go back to my original point about the amount of wildlife, 50% decline since 1970. That means to me that the Endangered Species Act has failed, and it's failed miserably. There's something like 3,500 endangered species that they know would fit the definition and that would qualify for protections, but they simply don't have the funding or the staff to actually investigate and make the final decision that these are endangered. So my point is, the regulatory framework that has built up over the last 50 or 60 years has largely been a way to distract environmentalists, to funnel them into ineffective means for fighting this culture. I've heard Thomas Lindsay, the executive director of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, who I know has been on the show a lot. He calls it the regulatory fallacy. He says that these laws have been intentionally written to make sure that environmentalists stay ineffective. And he said the only people that these laws regulate are environmentalists themselves. It's really important for a conversation about what is the purpose of the environmental movement to understand that these things have been ineffective, or to have a definition of what that purpose should be in order to evaluate whether the tactics that we've used or the tactics that we could use have been effective or not. So if you look at the regulatory framework, the laws like the Endangered Species Act, and ask if they've been successful, a lot of people would say, well, you know, I think there's been 10 species or something that have recovered after being listed on the Endangered Species Act. And that's definitely a good thing. I'm not trying to take away from that. It's just that, is that what we're trying to do? Are we just trying to save 10 species out of the tens of thousands that are seriously threatened with extinction? Does that help the 200 species that went extinct yesterday and the 200 species that are going to go extinct today? So we have to have an understanding of what the purpose of the environmental movement is before we can truly understand whether these tactics have been effective or not, and whether we can when we're evaluating where to put our time and our effort, it gives us a way to understand where we should be doing that.
So I want to ask you in a moment about what then is the purpose of the environmental movement and what should it be. But before we go there, I want to say that sometimes I myself get a little bit confused over all this, because I agree with much of the analysis that you just gave, and I agree with Thomas Lindsay's analysis, and I know at the same time that I'm going to give two more perspectives. One of them is that when we have filed timber sale appeals, we were really grateful for the Clean Water Act, and we were really grateful for the Endangered Species Act, because those gave us tools to actually protect old growth. And I don't really care what tools we use, whether they are legal tools or whether they are monkey wrenches. It doesn't matter to me, as long as the trees keep standing. And so there's a sense in which the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, NEPA, NFMA, all those did provide us with tools that we could use that helped on the ground, which doesn't alter what you're saying. And then I want to say one more perspective on this, which is that in the early 90s, when I was working with a group of people to use the existing laws to stop illegal timber sales in the national forests, I was playing a very small role in this, but the larger organizations were able to shut down about five national forests, the timber sale programs, because they were all illegal. And this was happening all over the country. And the response by the feds was to pass the salvage rider, which made it so basically it just said these all of the timber sales that we want to put out are no longer are suddenly exempt from environmental regulations. And one of the lessons that we learned from that was anytime you find tools to stop the destruction, those in power will change. Anytime you use their rules to stop the destruction, they will change the rules. So I end up getting really confused about all this because on one hand, I want any tools I can get, and the Endangered Species Act is one tool. On the other hand, when we can use it, then it's when it is used effectively, then it's torn away. And then there's your fundamental point too. So can you make some sense of this terrible question I've just asked you?
It wasn't a terrible question. It's a great question, and it's a question that it's a great question, and it's a question that the movement as a whole, we really need to understand it and come to some understandings about what's been happening. I think one of the ways that I think about it is I try and think about what it is that the law allows us to do. And the law, basically the practice of law is the practice of convincing a judge to authorize physical force to be applied to enforce that judge's decision to enforce the law. And, you know, it's really easy for us to understand this in a criminal setting. If a person has been convicted of murder, the judge can order bailiffs to take that person into custody, and either, you know, they could be executed or they can be locked away in prison for the rest of their lives. So the practice of law is then how lawyers try and convince a judge that that's what the judge should do. The same thing, if we expand that into the regulatory laws that we have, the same thing, we're trying to do the same thing. You're trying to keep old growth forests from being cut, and you are presenting the most persuasive arguments you can to a judge. And oftentimes the most persuasive argument is that Congress has passed this law that says you cannot, once this forest has been designated in a certain way, maybe it's critical habitat for, you know, the first thing I think of is the northern spotted owls. Once this forest has been designated critical habitat for these owls, this law says you can't cut it. It's clear cut. Well, sometimes corporations and others with tremendous amounts of resources and power can go in and they can influence government in such a large way that they can rewrite these laws. And that has happened. A history of a law like the Endangered Species Act is really the history of industry interests figuring out that the law has become a barrier to what they want to do, and then figuring out how they can influence the legislature to rewrite it. That I said all that because I think, again, the main point of law is the application of force to do what you want to do, or the application by the judge of force to support a particular side in a legal dispute. So I am very thankful that like you are, that there are these regulatory laws that have been able to slow down the destruction, prevent destruction in a lot of instances. But what I always want people to remember, and something that I think is getting more and more important to us as time keeps on passing and everything keeps getting worse. And things like dozens and dozens of species are going extinct every day. What I really want us to remember is that we don't have to always wait on a judge to apply physical force to protect the things that we love, that we are actually capable in a lot of instances of applying our own force to prevent things from happening. And I think that the thing that I really want people to think about when they're thinking about the law is the law can take a long time to resolve issues. It can take a lot of resources, a lot of money. A lot of times people have to appeal to experts. You have to hire a lawyer who has a license that can go into court for you and make the arguments. And in the end, the end goal is you're trying to get that judge, to say, if you try to clear cut this forest, I will, send the police to stop you from cutting that forest. Well, isn't it, you know, the thing I keep thinking of is, isn't it late enough in the game that, at a certain point, don't we have to start thinking, well, if we can't convince these judges to do the right thing, aren't we going to have to do the right thing for them? Aren't we going to have to become the police in a sense, or become the National Guard in a sense? And instead of trying to combat corporate attorneys in court and trying to beg judges to make the right decisions, how do we start to organize where we can just go out and do it?
So it seems that maybe not part of the problem, maybe all the problem, is that you can have, yes, I want to have tools that we can use to slow the destruction, but the real point is that it's absurd to think that it may be necessary but not sufficient to slow down the destruction, but obviously it's not sufficient because things are getting worse. And so you can have a law that was written with biophilic rhetoric, but within the context of an economic system and a social system that is both human supremacist and predicated on destroying the natural world to continue itself. And for crying out loud, gross domestic product is nothing but the measure of how quickly the living planet's converted into money. And so it seems part of the problem is that, and let me know if I'm misinterpreting you, but part of the problem is that we are attempting to use the rules of a rigged game in order to, I mean, it's like betting at a casino. You may win once in a while, but ultimately the house is going to win. Except in this case, it's the entire planet's going to lose, and capitalism is going to keep accumulating money as the world burns. Am I interpreting you fairly correctly?
Yeah. And I think the first thing I would say is, there are things that are so fundamentally written into individual minds, the individual minds that are responsible for administering the law. You know, the great quote, unquestioned beliefs are the real authority of any culture. Unquestioned beliefs are the real authority of any legal system, of any court system, of any legislature. And I think what's really happening is ideas that the economy is unqualified the most important thing in the world, ideas that commerce must be protected at all costs, that profit must be protected at all costs. These ideas are so firmly entrenched in the people that are in power and make decisions about laws that they don't even understand that, they don't even ask we have the Endangered Species Act, and yes, it says that we don't want any species to go extinct, but they can't really mean that they don't want all these species to go extinct if it means that we can't burn fossil fuels. The whole economy depends upon fossil fuels. So deeper than the idea that species need to be protected is the idea that the economy needs to be protected. And I think the real crux of the situation, the real problem is how do we raise generations of humans where the natural world is more sacred than the economy, where nature is not property, but is an exalted and sacred entity that idea is deeper than anything else. And I guess I don't think that until we're able to develop cultures that teach human beings these things, until those become the unquestioned beliefs of the culture, law is still going to serve whatever those unquestioned beliefs are.
Which leads us to the question of what is the purpose of environmentalism, because in the meantime, I mean, that you literally said generations, and of course it takes generations for those sorts of beliefs to metabolize their way into a system, and that will be especially difficult when there are those who are rewarded in every way for destroying, rewarded through esteem. We all know who Bill Gates is because he's rich. They're rewarded through power. They're rewarded through comforts and elegancies. So there are powerful motivators to not be biophilic. So given that reality, what is and what should be the purpose of the environmental movement?
The primary purpose of the environmental movement right now, judged on what most people who consider themselves environmentalists actually do and actually support, is to maintain the current way of living. It's to maintain the dominant culture for a little while longer. I think this is really problematic because the dominant culture is fundamentally unsustainable. The way that I think the most fundamental characteristic of the dominant culture is that it is civilization, and civilization is unsustainable. Civilization is based off of humans living in population densities so dense that they have to routinely import the necessities of life, food, water, material for their homes, that kind of thing. Well, when you require those things, you're going to strip an ever larger land base of those necessities of life, and it's just gonna keep growing and growing and growing. And that's what we've seen for the last 10,000 years. That's what civilization has done to the planet. It has become so horrifically deep, so deeply embedded in our very ways of life, that most people, I don't know about most people, but with a human population of 8 billion and growing, 8.5 billion and growing, a lot of humans, their very life requires civilization. The food that they get, the water that they drink, comes from ecocide, comes from stripping the land of what humans need. This idea that civilization is good is one of those unquestioned beliefs that runs so deeply. It's so prevalent that that's what most people think of when they think of the environmental movement. What should the goal of the environmental movement be? The goal of the environmental movement should be to save civilization, because humans can't exist without civilization in that framework. But so long as civilization remains unsustainable, which it always will, this goal is we could maybe make civilization a little kinder, a little gentler, but in the end we're on a plane that's going to crash. So what should the purpose of the environmental movement be?
Hold on. I want to say one thing about that, and then I'll let you get back to that if it's okay.
Yeah.
That this always makes me think of, you know, I think a lot of grassroots environmentalists really are fighting as hard as they can to protect this or that species. And what you're saying about the environmental movement as a whole, especially the nationals, the big ones, is true, absolutely true. And I think for myself too, that a lot of environmentalists, we're trying to protect this or that scrap of ground, we're trying to protect this or that being we love, and I keep thinking about something that Robert J. Lifton wrote about in The Nazi Doctors. And in that book, he asked how it was that people, men mainly, who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could work in a Nazi death camp. And what he found was that actually, and he's not talking about Mengele, he does talk about Mengele too, but Mengele was just a sadist and horrible, forget him now. Many of the Nazi doctors actually did everything they could to help individual patients. Their individual patients who were concentration camp inmates. So, for example, they would sneak them an extra scrap of potato. They would say, oh, this person's a little sick, so I need to put them to bed for a couple of days to let them rest from all the forced labor. Or they would hide them from the selection officers. And many of those doctors had tremendous gratitude from the individual inmates that they saved. But what they all did is they did everything they could in their power to help the inmates, except for the most important thing of all, which is they didn't question the existence of the death camp itself. And they didn't question working them to death, starving them to death, gassing them to death. So they earned the gratitude of some of the individuals they saved at the same time they were participating in the larger... And I don't want to minimize the importance of saving those individuals. I mean, many of us saw, what was the movie? Schindler's List.
Yeah.
And, you know, Schindler was a hero. And he was a real hero. No irony whatsoever. You know, he saved however many, but that doesn't alter the fact that there were millions killed. And so, as an environmentalist, I feel the same way, that we try to use these rules without... And that's one of the things I love about your work, is what you're doing right now is that you're questioning that larger superstructure that is the destruction of all that is. Okay, so now that I've rambled like that, either you can go respond to that or you can say what the environmental movement should be.
Yeah, I will respond to that because it's that question haunts me too. And the way that it has haunted me, I guess recently the biggest thing is I recently helped to file the first American federal lawsuit for a major ecosystem, rights of nature for a major ecosystem, for the Colorado River. And as I was doing this, I started to think about, what it would mean for the Colorado River to actually, be granted the right to exist, the right to flourish. And while I was traveling with the Colorado River, I was traveling with the Colorado River to try and see what was really witness what was going on, not just read about it, but actually go see it. And, we were at this fish hatchery in Grand Junction, Colorado, where they raised razorback, suckers and, a chub, a native chub. And the biologists that were working there were talking about how they're doing all this work, but then they were talking about how they had to filter the Colorado River water into the hatchery so that they could raise these fish. And the reason they had to filter the water is there was so much mercury in the water that it was really hard for the baby fish to be born and then to survive in the water itself. And then they said the thing that really gets to this is that the mercury was mainly coming from coal power plants on the Asian continent and was blowing across halfway around the world and affecting the Colorado River. And it's, you know, what hit me was, you know, you could do so many things for the Colorado River in right here in the United States and use the entire American governmental system to protect the Colorado River, but you still couldn't affect what was going on the Asian continent. So, you know, that has hit me squarely in the face, and it's made me really think about, you can take anyone, any place that you love, and you can physically protect it. You can physically protect a section of old growth forest, but if climate change keeps running away like it is, and it runs away to the point where the trees are not adapted to the climate there, then that old growth forest will die. You can protect a rare spring and the frogs that are in that spring, but if snowfall or springs or wetlands and snowfall patterns are affected by climate change to the point that the snow doesn't fall anymore, those frogs are still going to die. And I don't know what the right answer is for the very few environmentalists, the very few of us who are fighting like hell to keep those places alive and those species alive. I don't know what to say to people about that. I just know that the problem is so big that we have to start thinking about what is the source of the biggest problems and how we have to affect those problems as soon as possible, because everything is getting killed and everything will get killed if we don't challenge the whole system, if we don't ask why the concentration camp exists in the first place.
So two things. One is, I live on 40 acres of second growth forest that, that my mom and I have protected, and it's one of the things that I have that has broken my heart in this is that even though, yes, I understand that there might be less migratory songbirds because they die somewhere else, but roly-polies, there are fewer roly-polies, and I guarantee that the individual roly-polies do not have a range of larger than 40 acres. So there has been a collapse. Even I don't understand it. I want to interview someone about the insect apocalypse in general, but also specifically about what is happening to creatures who are living, and this is happening in even huge, huge places that are protected, that you can protect this area that's big enough for grizzly bears, but there can still be a population collapse of caddisflies or someone else whose range is 20 square yards. And so I'm just validating what you're saying in that I don't know why the insect populations are collapsing on this land when they should be fine. And then the larger point is, it seems to me, and then I'm going to say something and I'm going to ask you. So it seems to me, and we have like 5 minutes left, it seems to me that that ultimately the purpose of the environmental movement, yes, it's really, really important. You have to have people who are protecting every scrap of ground, every single scrap of ground, every single river, every single marsh, every single everything. Those need to be protected. And at the same time, it seems if all we're doing is holding on by our fingernails and praying for civilization to collapse, it seems to me that at some point part of the environmental movement should be about hastening that collapse if we really are biophilic and if we really do care more about the health of the land than we do the economic system.
Yeah, I think that.
And I don't want you to say anything that will get you disbarred, by the way.
Sometimes that license is more of a hassle than it needs to be. That is something that I'm, what you're saying about, if we're truly biophilic, won't we hasten the collapse? And I think that is really where we have to realize that, and then we have to change our tactics based upon that realization. And one way I look at this, or one thing that always makes me cringe, is the way that oftentimes environmentalists talk about how much time we have left, or they put deadlines on things. If we only cut carbon emissions by 80% by 2050, then we'll be okay. And the truth is, we haven't been okay in some places for thousands of years. We're not okay. We're not okay right now. Things will not be okay. The future that those who follow us are inheriting is so impoverished compared to what it should have been, what a healthy planet would have looked like. Their future has been robbed from them. Our present future is so impoverished based off what has come before us. And it, to me, and I know that this is a very, maybe, a very hard way of looking at things, but it's almost, if dozens of species are going extinct today, that means that literally every hour that passes that this culture keeps on destroying is a defeat. And if we ultimately bring about the collapse, the collapse is going to happen because it's propped up by unsustainability. But when that finally happens, every one of these hours that passes is a defeat, is worthy of moral blame, I think, from the future. People that follow us are going to look back and say, yeah, you did it in 2040. Why didn't you do it in 1940? And, you know, I don't know what all the implications of that way of thinking are. I think it's a hard way, especially for the people that are doing great work in on their land bases where they are. I just know that if we don't start thinking about how big the problem is and how to truly uproot the biggest problems, then we're still going to lose. And we really need to start having that conversation.
So that would be a beautiful place to end, but I want to, you are a very interesting person who has very interesting, you are multifaceted, and I want to read the beginning of your piece, First There's the World, a Manifesto. I want to read the first paragraph, because you're not only a lawyer, but you're a poet. First there's wind kissing your breast, chills chapping your lips, and frost on your sleeping bag before dawn. First there's salmon swimming upstream, heron stalking bluegill, and grizzly bear brothers wrestling. First there's nimble clean water chasing over pebbles, ice cracking in the warmth of spring, and sand dragging over desert floors. First there's the world, then there's poetry. And I love that. It's both beautiful and also, I think it's one of the most important messages that there are, that there is this insanity in this culture that we think that what humans create is superior to what everyone else creates. There's that only humans create art, and that only humans create beauty, and only humans are capable of recognizing beauty, and that the economic system is more important than life on the planet. But I love it. You encapsulated everything into two sentences. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 words. 9 if you, depending on how you count, contractions. First there's the world, then there's poetry. And it seems to me that's the most important lesson that we have to have, is first there's the world, then there's everything else. And can you talk about that for just a moment? We have like 1 minute left, 2 minutes left.
Yes, there is no poetry without the natural world. There's no life without the natural world. And in the way I see things, poetry should always be a function of life. Poetry should be committed to the truth. And if when so many things are being destroyed around you, if you're going to be an honest poet or an honest writer, then you're
an honest lawyer
or an honest lawyer, then you have to commit yourself to changing that, to stopping that. You cannot love life, you cannot love poetry without fighting against those who are destroying life and therefore destroying poetry.
Well, thank you so much for your work in the world, and thank you for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Will Falk. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.